Hello and welcome to Radio Aldie with me, Harrow Mount, editor of the Aldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to the great actor Kenneth Cranham, who has written a terrific piece in the new Aldie about the King, Elvis Presley, who would have been 90 on January the 8th. And Ken, dare I say it, you're just about to turn 80.
I'm 80.
If only we could have got Elvis age 90 to write about Ken Cranham age 80, but it's the other way around. Ken, you written this brilliant piece about Elvis, and you say you first fell for Elvis in 1957 when you were 13 in Stockwell. And what was it about him?
I just thought that he was extraordinary and very beautiful and totally exciting. I mean, no one had seen anything like him. There was... it's hard to find anyone to compare him to. And it's interesting in that he made a Western. He did work in cinemas. That was one of his jobs. And he did tell Tony Curtis that the reason he had black hair was because he dyed it black. But I never saw him without black hair, did you?
No, but he is supposed to be dishwater blonde, was supposed to be his hair.
Something like that. Yeah. And so Tony Curtis is sort of endlessly sort of pleased that Elvis said that to him, that it was he saw him, he was a movie usher, so he saw these films over and over again. And my own sort of childhood in Scotland and in Camberwell, there were four cinemas and a variety theatre still running. And in Scotland, there were two cinemas in the small town that my mother lived in that changed double features three times a week. So you just saw film after film after film. And, you know, films that we can't imagine anymore. And in the next town, Cowdenbeath, on Sunday, I would go there and see what was on there. And they did, you know, those things in children's cinema where they had a serial and there's a terrible dilemma at the end of each episode. Yeah. In Scotland, they used to show those in the adult cinema. Young mothers would breastfeed their babies inside the cinema. People lived in cinemas, and my mother talked of Fred and Ginger. You know, they were part of her conversation. And she was the one, if Elvis made a film that was an A, she'd have to go and see the Elvis, take me to the Elvis film. Now, there was a whole industry which in this country which was actually based on Elvis. There was somebody called Jack Good, who was a sort of master television program maker. He made this thing, Oh Boy, which was, you know, a rock and roll show, really, and it was on every week, and it created stars, and many of them were just based on Elvis. The best Elvis impersonator we had was Billy Fury. But Jack Good was obsessed with Elvis. And he would say things like, oh, well, he's put on a bit of weight and everything. And people would get very sort of wrapped up in Elvis. And the next best one, oddly enough, was Cliff Richard. Yeah. But Jack Good had actually persuaded Cliff Richard to lift his lip and sneer. And that's how his Elvis became quite... And so that we had all these... Billy Fury did a wonderful version of Baby Let's Play House, which nobody else other than Elvis could do.
But to go back to your first meeting, as it were, with Elvis, 1957, Loving You comes out. 56, the year before, is when Elvis made it big. Love Me Tender came out. But it's 57 when you first were knocked out by it.
Yeah, and I saw him in Stockwell all on my own. And actually, what the director had done is he'd gone and seen Elvis on the road in the South and actually based a film around Elvis's stage show. That's what he'd done. And there was a little sort of rep company of sort of featured players that, you know, you got the awful nasty uncle figure and you got the good-looking blonde and the virginal nun that Elvis fell in love with when they were filming and all that. But it was a magical film.
But you were blown away by him. It was a kind of
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And the last sequence of the film was actually him doing a stage show dressed in denims, in jeans and a jean jacket, which Elvis didn't like that, but it's fantastic. And and my mother said to people, oh, he loves Elvis, this is his new thing. And I had three Elvis records, two of them with the same bloody record on the 78. It was, someone had gone, can I have the latest Elvis present? And so I had two of them that were the same.
Which were they, do you remember?
Yeah, they were, Got a Lot of Living to Do and Let's Have a Party, either side of a 78. But the next record I bought was also on 78, HMV, a blue label. And it was That's When Your Heartaches Begin, with All Shook Up on the Other Side. Now, that's an amazing record. And That's When Your Heartaches Begin has got a spoken passage. And by then, Elvis had sort of conquered the speaking passage. He got rather good at that. And I used to identify with all my sort of romantic sort of mishaps. I used to listen to that and sort of identify.
Did you do an impression as a great actor to be? Did you do impressions of him? And then when you were your
I did entire shows as Elvis, and I did entire fights on my own as Muhammad Ali. And yes. I don't know what I thought I was doing, really, but you know that there was quite a gap between me and my brother, so I had a lot of time to indulge these fantasies. But
you say in the piece, it was said of Muhammad Ali when he beat Sonny Liston that he shook the world.
I shook the world. And I
said, King had done it.
He shook the world in Technicolor. It's a beautiful film, Loving You. It's wonderful. And all on my own, I was completely captivated by it. And the next film was Jailhouse Rock. And that fantastic number, Jailhouse Rock, they were going to use that as an opening sequence, but no, they said no, and they placed it, they gave it a much better placing in the middle of the film. And then the next film, the black and white film, King Creole, was Michael Curtis, who'd done Casablanca, I think. Or does that sound likely?
Anyway. No, I think it is. Yeah.
And he was made to sort of, it was rather sort of odd, because he was playing somebody who was still at school, and he didn't look young enough for that. But he, and all of these, those films, the main writers were Lieber Stoller. And they had sort of come up through their love of R&B and black musicians. That's what's happened to them. And they were terribly offended by Elvis's version of Hound Dog, and they went on about it for some time, because they'd written it from Mama Thornton, who was a big black mama, and it's a song, You're Nothing But a Hound Dog. But I think it works wonderfully sung to a woman. and Elvis had seen a version of it at Vegas, and that record sold 7 million copies. On the other side of it, Don't Be Cruel, if it's playing in the background, it's actually very sophisticated gospel music. It's like the sort of very white gospel songs. And Elvis was, his friendship with Tom Jones was partly based on each of them having encyclopedias of gospel songs that they both knew. And because Elvis liked nothing more than to stay up half the night. And poor Tom Jones actually, at certain points, wanted to go to bed, and Elvis wouldn't let him leave. And
there was again, you're an encyclopedic in your art, and you very kindly sent me tapes, and you talk about your tapes in this article, which you've done this brilliant thing of taking the original songs often sung by black American singers and Elvis's versions. And you quote Elaine Dundy, who we'll come on to in a moment, but she says this great thing of he took these songs, which were wonderful in the first place, but he created art by turning them into something different.
Yes, he did. But there was somebody, that's not in the article, called Paul Kennelly. Now, Paul Kennelly was an English songwriter, and he actually ended up going to live in Nashville, and he made a series of concept albums of country music, and he married Emmylou Harris. He took it that far. And for a time, I would go up to his sort of eyrie at the top of his house, and he introduced me to the Stanley Brothers. Now, the Stanley Brothers are the basis for Gillian Welch's career. You know, this wonderful, high, falsetto mountain music. And so, you know, they became an ingredient in the tapes that I made. And I did a film, a rough little film. A director had got the rights to make a sort of little stage play into a film, but it meant that I could go to Texas. What's the town called? The music town in Texas. It's got a university, and it's this is my problem is trying
to. I can remember otherwise. It'd be a big town, but yeah. Anyway, yeah.
It's not a big town. It's a middling town with a university, and I made this daft film there. But I went to an all day gospel show while I was there, and there was this wonderful, elegant, youngish, about 30 black woman, and I waited and I talked to her. And she told me that she was playing with gospel groups and as on bass, and as soon as she got a bit better, she was going to move on to blues groups. And I thought, this is the film I should be making, not this terrible old dialogue that I'm trying to sort of struggle with. This is really interesting. And so that was an all-day gospel show.
And you can trace the same... He's a genius, Elvis, but you can trace... A lot of the elements are logical. Born in Tupelo, Mississippi,
yeah,
90 years ago. So he gets access to black music, gospel music, country and western music, and he listens to it all. He absorbs everything. He's a sponge.
The radio, and they had very powerful transmitters. They actually could be heard clearly. Music was Elvis's obsession. And that's partly why he bonded so strongly with Tom Jones, because Tom Jones had absorbed a lot of black music and gospel music. And they each did a version of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and it's identical. They actually phrased it completely the same way. And Tom Jones, in the Vegas years, they really became very close. And they would go... They have little... theatres, not the main ones, but little smaller houses, and they would go and see Fats Domino, they were together. They would go and see Chuck Berry together, who were playing the smaller houses. And Elvis said to Tom Jones about Chuck Berry, he said, he's the real king of rock and roll. And so, you know, they had a fantastic sort of bond between... Tom Jones said it wasn't a good idea to get photographed with Elvis, because you would never come out of it well.
Yes, there's a wonderful photo of them together. But so, exactly, so Fats Domino, Chuck Berry,
yeah,
Bill Haley are all before Elvis. Were you aware of any of those?
Oh, totally, 57? Totally.
So it wasn't like Elvis came out of nowhere. When you were a 13-year-old boy, you were already aware of rock and roll.
Yeah, but I actually had a sort of life under an eiderdown. I had my own little single bed. My brother was somewhere else in the house, but I would actually listen to Radio Luxembourg. That's how you could hear these people. You could occasionally hear them on Family Favourites. It'd be the odd track here and there, but you could actually hear Little Richard, Elvis Presley, and even the softer stuff like Ricky Nelson and things like that. But I even liked Pat Boone's Wonderful Time Up There, which was, you know, a very... white version.
Voice too. Yeah.
And he used to tell a story, Pat Boone, of Elvis and him crossing paths at an airport, and Elvis said to him, "Still going in the wrong direction, Pat," and all the rest of it. Pat said, "Well, you know, look what happened to Elvis," sort of thing. But you know, Elvis sort of had a rather glorious life for all its terrible disaster, because he did actually managed to saturate himself in music. That was his sort of passion, and it stayed with him. And early on, he looked so beautiful. Who's that? who's the famous tailor here that with all the English, very English tailor, the trendy one, what's he called? Paul, is it?
Paul Smith, no?
Paul Smith,
yeah.
Talks about the beauty of Elvis circa Jan House Rock. You know that.
Yeah,
that,
wonderful looking. Yeah.
Yes, that's what he thinks that was his epitome of being good looking, and I suspect that he was good looking then just because of physical exertion. Years later, I think he kept his weight down in other ways, which he discovered in the army. You know, because they'd keep them up all night and everything else.
Yeah. And introduce him to drugs and the beginning of the end. Although, as you know, in 1973, Aloha from Hawaii, it's only 4 years before he died. He's looking fantastic then, isn't he? So it needn't have been that catastrophic fat Elvis end.
Who knows? We don't know about what drugs actually do in the end, do we? I came across this, which I was very moved by. This is one of the main songwriters for Elvis, Lieber. If my next medical report is Lieber, you've run out of options. You've got a month almost to put your affairs in order. Then this is my plan. I'm going to buy a fifth of Maker's Mark bourbon, a carton of Camels, and as many Billie Holiday records as I can carry. I'm going to break out the booze and have a ball.
That's great.
Isn't it good?
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. And Elvis never got that chance. He went, was he 42 when he died?
42, yeah.
Yes.
42, no, it's a terrible tragedy. And it's funny, I was talking to you the other day, Ken, about an actor I thought was good, and you said, yes, he can do it. And I don't really think this is about acting, but, you know, you're a genius actor. And you either can do it or you can't. You think same with Elvis. You can look at the strands of his life, his upbringing, but then there's something beyond that, the magic ingredient. I don't know where it comes from the gods, whatever you want to call it. But then
yes.
It's the same in the acting world, isn't it? Something is just there, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was blessed. He was blessed. And I mean, Tony Curtis, I saw him interviewed recently, and he said that this critic had said, finally, we've found an actor worse than Tony Curtis, and his name is Elvis Presley. And Tony Curtis said, he wouldn't know talent if it sat on his face.
And Ken, we'll move on to your brilliant article, which is a brilliant original way into the King, because so much has been written about him. But you formed a friendship, not in the flesh, with Elaine Dundee.
Yes.
About Elvis, can you explain how that came about?
Well, it came about because I was going to Ireland with my family, and I was staying in a boarding house which didn't even have a bar or a television, and I had to raid my own bookcase. And one of the things that I'd bought was a book by Elaine Dundee, which was specifically about Elvis's mother. Now, I knew quite a lot about the father. And there's various stories that you hear that the reason that Colonel Tom made Jailhouse Rock was to let Elvis know that he knew what his background was.
Bernard had been to jail.
Yeah, and he'd done some pathetic sort of forgery and sort of. And Elvis, as a boy, I don't know what sort of setup he was, that they had to be driven miles, and Elvis and would have to sit in a room while his mum and dad got together and were allowed some sort of sex, maybe, yeah. I don't know, whatever. But it was something he was deeply ashamed of. And I suppose that, you know, you hear all these things about the Colonel. Some people think the Colonel was wonderful. I don't know what the truth is. What do you think?
There's an argument for saying he made him, isn't he, when he bought out Sam Phillips.
Yeah.
He made him on a huge international scale, but then he did rip him off with a 50-50 deal, didn't he? And he kept on forcing him to do the Vegas shows, exhausting him because he was a gambling addict, wasn't he?
He was all going on on the roulette table.
Yeah.
Some of the Elvis's, you know, musicians have said he shouldn't have been made to do two shows a day, because he was using medication for the second show. Now, I think possibly his exertions, physical, they kept him in good shape before he went into the army. Then in the army, he discovered uppers.
And, stay up all night
because they'd give them to you when you were on duty. And I'm sure that he had no problem getting hold of anything. And so he was never a drinker. Occasionally be seen with a cheroot.
Yeah.
But he didn't drink.
And he convinced himself that the drugs he took were fine because they were prescription drugs. But I'm sure you've seen the prescriptions he had, which were from Dr. Nick, which were literally thousands.
Well, he could call them medication, you see. He could think that's what they were. And there is a story about him bumping into, either by design or accident, Marilyn Monroe. And she was very put off by Elvis's companions, who were quite sort of, the gang he hung out with, because he kept a little tribe around him. What he'd noticed was her on her medication, and he, before he knew it, he'd gone to this guy and was getting whatever. That's a rather interesting little detail.
Yes, but the relationship with his mother was often instrumental because they were so close, and she died in...
But it was partly because they lived in such poverty, and he was one of twins, and the other twin had died at birth, and Elvis actually kept up a spiritual relationship with his dead twin. He did visit the grave, he did talk to this twin, and so he had a feeling of sort of fear about the whole thing, and the mother was very comforted. I mean, there is an episode, he actually knew by heart the script of the Rebel Without a Cause. He knew every line of it. And he actually took Natalie Wood home to Memphis. And, of course, the mother was very suspicious about all that. And she phoned up Dennis Hopper and said, look, get me out of this, phone me up and say that I've got to leave and all the rest of it.
But anyway, so with Elaine Dundy... You enjoyed her book about Gladys and Elvis.
What was extraordinary was this image, which I didn't know anything about. His mother was employed as a buck dancer, and they would have these gatherings in the South, open air. They'd probably have a piano, a boogie piano, whatever, and they would drink. And she was employed to get the party off the ground as a buck dancer, they called it. And I thought, well, she was a buck dancer, and she was very beautiful for a time.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was a drinker and died young. And I thought, well, Elvis became the greatest buck dancer there'd ever been.
But anyway, Ken, so you got into correspondence with Elaine Dundy, and you discussed your tapes, and she turned out to be a great analyst of Elvis, isn't that right?
In her old age, she was absorbed by the Elvis Presley world. They looked after her in her old age, and they were very pleased to have somebody who was a proper writer writing about Elvis, because there was a terrible hatchet job from, what was he called?
Oh, yes, after he died, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, before he died.
Which was very ruinous for Elvis. And he wrote these books all about how much more talented than whoever he wrote about he was. Golding was his name?
Goldman.
What I love is that Goldman got into such a state when he was on a flight trying to get himself upgraded that he had a heart attack and died.
King wouldn't have done that.
No, even the king wouldn't have had to do that sort of thing at all. No.
And then you also got in correspondence with another great Elvis fan, the late Duchess of Devonshire, is that right?
Well, what happened is that I found out that she was obsessed by entertainers. There were certain entertainers, and somebody like Ethel Merman or somebody, she went every night when she played London. And she was influenced by Fred Astaire's sister. She actually had access to her.
Oh, because she married an uncle, I think.
That's right. Good. So she had access to all her records and stuff. And so that had influenced her. But she pointed out to me, she sent me an Elvis photo. It which wasn't something I was short of.
But I must say to listeners, Ken does these fantastic collages of Elvis from all his career, so he has access to a lot of Elvis pictures, yeah.
Yes, and but she wrote to me and said that what she was interested in was she called it the operatic Elvis. Now, I suppose what she meant was that the big band Elvis and she would go and see those touring shows where Elvis isn't there, but everything else is and everything. And she spoke very motherly about the Swedish inspirations, having put on a little weight and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And through her, she, Candida Lysett Green,
daughter of John Betjeman, yeah.
Yeah, she dedicated quite a few of her books to the Duchess. You know, she loved the Duchess. And Rupert Lysett Green is a real Elvis obsessive and never forgave himself for not making it to Vegas, because he was in America at that time and everything. And because if you went down there was somebody on the door. If you slipped him a few quid, you get a ringside seat. You know, it was quite sort of corrupt, the whole thing. It would have been worth investigating.
My God. And Ken, because, you know, there you say age 13 in 1957, you fall in love with Elvis, and you've sent me these terrific collages. Was it an obsession that grew, or did it wane and then peak? Or
no, it sort of, it took me in strange directions. His career reviving like it did. I was up in Manchester. I was playing, who was the wonderful Manchester Guardian writer?
J.B. Priestley.
No, not him. The war correspondent. And I played him in a thing about Suez. My memory is now terrible.
Yeah.
Anyway, I actually sat with him in the Midland Hotel, but in the same hotel was Jeremy, who was once in Zedcars. He became a rather grand actor. Anyway, he was in the Midland Hotel, and the Elvis show was on, not in the pub I was staying in, it was in the hotel, and he let me watch the Elvis show in his room.
But Ken, because the other amazing thing about Elvis is, in his short life, he went through many incarnations. So there's the very young Sun Sessions Elvis.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the films Love Me Tender, Loving You, late 50s. There's the famous not-so-good films in the 60s, although some wonderful songs, the 68 comeback specials, then there's the 70s Vegas shows, Aloha from Hawaii. What's your favourite period?
Well, I loved the film Loving You. I thought it was a jewel of a piece. I liked King Creole and Jailhouse Rock's got, you know, I mean, there's a colourised version of Jailhouse Rock that you can get, you know. It's a sort of, it's quite an industry, the Elvis industry. And like my Fiona, we both went on our own to see the Western, what was that called? It's no songs in it at all. And I walked from Tulse Hill to Streatham to the cinema, and I was a shilling short of what I needed to see this film. I walked all the way home, got a shilling, and walked all the way back. I did this epic journey four times to see the film. There's no songs in it at all. It's a Western. Now, at the Watford Palace, which is outside London, they did a play called Dance with the Dolly. And what it was about was this strange merging of cabaret and rock and roll, which went on in this country. It was written by Jack Pullman. Constance Cummings was playing the aging cabaret artiste, and I was playing the young rock and roller, and they have an affair. And her brother, William Lucas, finds out about this and betrays her and everything else, and she commits suicide. And it was directed by Giles Havergal, designed by Philip Prowse, before they went up to Glasgow and sort of took over the Glasgow sits up there. And I didn't have a song in it, but I had a grey shirt of silk, and I looked the part, and Larry Parnes expressed interest in representing me, even though I hadn't sung or anything in this, but it was obviously just the sort of thing that he liked. Now, he had this stable of English rock stars, Billy Fury, Tommy Steele, Vince Eger. He always did this thing.
Made up names.
Yeah. And he had a soft name and a hard name. I don't know if Tommy Steele was one of his, perhaps he was, but they were all... Now, Jack Good was part of this industry. They were all trying to find somebody to do Elvis songs. And the best one by far was Billy Fury, who did a blinding version of Baby Let's Play House. It's really good, his version of it. The next best one, oddly enough, was Cliff Richard.
He was very good.
Yeah, but Jack Good persuaded him to snarl, which he never did, and look a bit sweaty. You know, it was, and he did that, and he did a song, Turn Me Loose, and that was a very good sort of Elvis pastiche that he did. And indeed, he expressed interest. And it was a great play about that era, because to see Duane Eddy and his twangy guitar, I had to travel to Finsbury Park for the first time in my life and see the first house. And I had to sit through Frank Ifield and Des O'Connor to see Duane Eddy and his twangy guitar. It's a strange world. And so this play, Dance with the Dolly, was about that strange merge that went on in this country of rock and roll and aging cabaret artists. And Giles Havergal, the director, when I discover my character discovers that she's committed suicide and she's dead, he persuaded me to lie on the ground and punch the surface with my fist, which I did. Got a terrible laughter from the audience. I thought, thanks a bunch.
And Ken, tell me, difficult question, have you got a favourite Elvis song?
No, there are too many. But what I think is, I had that 78, which on one side is All Shook Up, and the other side is That's When Your Heartaches Begin. And one of his first conquering of doing the dramatic recitation. He did that rather well back then.
Does it in Are You Lonesome Tonight?
Yeah. And there's all sorts of things that I like. I think it's incredibly sad what happened to him, but strangely sort of triumphant in some sort of way.
Well, he still packed a lot in, didn't he?
He packed a lot in, and I think possibly the drugs that he got into, I think it's probably related to things he discovered in Germany in the army.
I think that's what they say, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And he was never a drinker.
And what do you think, if he was alive now, about 90, what sort of music would he be doing now, do you think?
Well, whenever he couldn't sleep, he would get up and he would play the piano and sing. I mean, music was his complete obsession. And the last songs that he sung were, I think it was Unchained Melody.
It was, is that, and Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
Blue Eyes Crying, now I think Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain is a wonderful song, and I've got many different versions of it. So, you know, we could perhaps say that would do, but he was such an encyclopedia. On his Elvis's Back, when he came out of the army, and two of the songs that he recorded, Peggy Lee's Fever and Johnny Ray's Such a Night, all wonderful versions. And that was an homage, wasn't it, to the two great performers that he could manage. There wasn't anything outside his range, although the voice got weaker later on.
But still, in that, I'm sure you've seen that moving film of his last tour, just before he died. He's in a terrible state, but his voice, in fact, he sings Unchained Melody.
Yeah,
his voice is still fantastic. It's got a bit deeper, isn't it? But it's still...
Yes. He can still thrash it. No, it's operatic, actually, yeah, isn't it? Yeah. It's operatic.
And, Ken, I must finish. Elvis would have been 90. You're a mere stripling of almost 80. How do you feel about turning 80?
Well, I've... how do I feel about it? Well, I'm glad to be alive. Although the problem with acting is memory. That defeats a lot. I mean, Gambon was very...
He had a feed, didn't he?
Sometimes admit to that and sometimes they don't. But, I mean, I was working with somebody and she thought, well, it's absurd that I have to stop working. But she had idiot boards, and they said to me, do you want idiot boards? I said, look, if I get idiot boards, I've got to wear glasses. I can't read them, you know. I mean, and you know, so that is the struggle.
Although, Ken, you've just done very kindly for all the fantastic readings of Wilfred Owen, all from memory. So I don't think
all from memory. No, yeah. but you have to understand that when I was at school, I really couldn't be bothered with Jane Austen, but I thought that Wilfred Owen was cinema of the heart. Really, I just thought it was the most extraordinary stuff. And it's like a film script, those poems, and they've stayed with me. I've known them that long, and so they'll still be there.
Well, cinema of the heart, lovely expression. It's a good place to stop. Thanks so much, Ken, for appearing on Radio Aldi. Happy 80th birthday, Ken Cranham, and happy 90th birthday to the King, Elvis Presley.